You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
gonna do?
Do you really think that?
Do you think it all? Yeah.
Our government cares about you.
They ain't giving up a second thought about you. No. Ghetto people.
Who you gonna turn to next?
Tell me. With your life
running like a red disease,
running like a red disease. Ghetto people,
stop giving up yourself.
Stop doing what you're doing to yourself, young. You got to learn to love yourself.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe, civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement: Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted. And we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. Hotel family, hope everything is well with you today. Hope you're going to have a great weekend. So I hope you get a chance to do all the things that you want to do, should do, must do, can do, and will do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But of course, if it's not, and it has to be done, it must be done, you will do it. And you will do it safely. And we appreciate you. You ain't going to procrastinate. No, you're going to get it done. This is African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. till to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, and any other time around the world. If you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com. At the top of the page, you'll see podcasts. Click on that. The drop down, you'll see African Perspectives, and there will be programs that are dated and titled. Other programming we have here on Time for an Awakening Media. Once again, this program may be Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern. And all times are going to give our Eastern times. On Mondays, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, public affairs programming out of Philadelphia with Brother Jihad Ahmed. And that's followed by, from 8 p.m. to 9, Black Therapy Central with Dr. Mawia Kambon and Nataki Kambon, her daughter Nataki Kambon. And then from 9 to 10, Conversations, Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey of Encobra. On Tuesdays, from 8 p.m. to 10, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers every Tuesday. On Wednesdays, the Black Farmers Report on Wednesdays from 8 to 9. If it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern, it's time for an awakening, brothers and sisters, for Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, 8 p.m. on Fridays. Saturday, from 4 p.m. to 6, Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers on Saturdays from 4 to 6. And then Saturday evening from 7 p.m. to 9, the Sankofa Elders Council. On Sunday at 7 p.m., once again, it's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And the number to call is 215-490-9832, 215-490-9832. We Buy Black. We Buy Black. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses from WeBuyBlack.com. The largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses is WeBuyBlack.com. And if you have Facebook, I'm not sure if you've seen some Facebook postings of WeBuyBlack.com offering free delivery with your purchase and so forth. All right. Africa for the Africans. Africa for the Africans. Brother Bamani Taihemba just got back from Ghana. He was there from May 24th to June 5th. And I look forward to talking with him here on the program to find out what you can do to access an upcoming tour that Brother Bamani has slated. The next one up is November 18th through the 29th in Tanzania. November 18th through the 29th. And then December 24th to January 5th, 2022, to Ghana. And then April 1st to April 11th, 2022, in Senegal and Gambia. Those are the latest trips. And of course, you can go to the website, AfricaForTheAfricans.org, and believe me, everything that you need will be right there for you to make that trip of a lifetime, okay? But if you want to see videos of previous tours, videos, go to youtube.com/Bomani2007. If you want to see pictures of previous tours, go to facebook.com/Bomani. And if you want to give them a call, please do at 404-931-9429, 404-931-9429. Dr. Rinoco Rashidi, Baba Rinoco, he has a trip upcoming to, he's going to be going to Ghana, July 18th through August 3rd. And he'll be leaving there, from there going to Kemet, July 31st to August 13th. And on the Ghana tour, he's going to be with Professor Small and Dr. Lynn Jeffries. And then on the Kemetic tour, he's going to have a great number of people. So he also has a webinar coming up on Eventbrite, Africa, Star Over Europe. And that'll be Friday, June 25th, 8 p.m. Eastern time, from 8 p.m. to 9:30 Eastern time. And the next day, Saturday, June 26th, 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. That's going to be on a webinar. So check it out. Go to drrinoco.com, drrinoco.com. If you want to contact Baba Rinoco, you can give him a call at 323-803-8663, or you can contact him through email, which he prefers, at rinoco@hotmail.com. Rinoco@hotmail.com. Habesha Incorporated.org. Helping Africa by establishing schools at home and abroad. Habesha Incorporated.org. It's very important that we support what these brothers and sisters are doing. Go to their website and you'll see the many programs they're having here in the Atlanta area and in Ghana, the Kashi Project in Ghana. There'll be pictures of the things that they're doing there. Habesha is a Pan-African organization that cultivates leadership in youth families through practical experiences in cultural education and sustainable agriculture, entrepreneurship, holistic health, and technology. And they also, there's a program to help you repatriate, repatriation initiative through Habesha Incorporated. .org. The Ledge Group. Ledge stands for Land for the Environmental Development of Group Economics. And of course, the Ledge Group has done outstanding work on the continent. In fact, even in Tanzania, there's a raffle that they're offering on their page, Ledge, theledgegroup.com. If you go to theledgegroup.com, you can find out exactly how you can access the raffle. But they also, if you become a member of the Ledge Group, you have the opportunity to buy land in Tanzania at $250 an acre. Get you 4 acres, that's $1,000, a lot of land. The Ledge Group, of course, the Ledge Group, they deal in the four essentials for human development: food, water, clothing, and shelter. These multiple projects that are going on in 12 different projects in 6 different countries, over 170 employed and over 260 members. TheLedgeGroup.com. BBToomey.com. ABIBITUMI.com. BBToomey.com. Brothers and sisters, I'm suggesting that you go to BBToomey, become a member, utilize that website. It has a lot of good information, stuff to buy and so forth. And there's seminars, the Saturday seminars. This Saturday is African Spirituality, Concepts of the Person. The person has multiple selves. African Spirituality. And that is at 1 p.m. Eastern time. 1 p.m. Eastern time from 1 to 3 on Saturday. And then on Saturday, June 19th, How can I have more? An everyday guide to joys of cooking and eating like an African. It's vegan. Okay. And then on Sunday the 20th, Black Manhood, Affirming Black Manhood.
taking back the power to defend, to define and defend and demonstrate what black manhood is and needs to become. I'll get more on that a little next week. And on the 6th, Saturday 26th, Saturday seminar, African Combat Forms Hidden in Plain Sight. Africans combat forms hidden in plain sight. So these seminars and this information is vital. And hopefully you can go to Bibi Atumi and access them. Okay. Wadada's Healthy Market and Juice Bar, located in the West End. Here in Atlanta, I'm Ralph David Abernathy, right across the street from Soul Veg, up the street from the Shrine of Black Madonna, which is open. The Shrine is open on Fridays and Saturdays from 1 to 7 on Friday and Saturday. They have a range of things, furniture, clothing, artwork, you name it, the red, black, and green shoes, and, of course, books at the Shrine of the Black Madonna. Go check them out. And my friend with the bookstore, of course, is Mama Nia at Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall. And she has a nice place right there in the main corridor of the Greenbrier Mall now. Give her a call at 404-346-3263. 404-346-3263. She has a fine selection of books, postcards, greeting cards, gift certificates, figurines, t-shirts, and all kinds of good stuff at the Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall. The other bookstore we promote, of course, is the Black Dot Cultural Center and Bookstore with Gazimde Ajamu in Lithonia. There is light in the black dot. Support my brother Gazimde Ajamu. He made a coffee bar in his place and serving delicious coffees. Of course, Cameroon Boyo, my favorite, but others as well, as well as African teas and so forth. So check him out. Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People in the Spirit of Ujamaa. Last night, their Thursday night broadcast, I listened to it. Good information. Every Thursday night from 9 to 10. Thursday night from 9 to 10 on Blog Talk Radio. That's blogtalkradio.com/ULU, Us Lifting Us. But if you want to call to listen, you can do so. But if you want to ask questions or comments or concerns, you can do so as well. They'll put you in the queue. And as I do is after you dial, you press 1 and you're in your comments. And so you dial this number, 929-477-2789. That's 929-477-2789. Us Lifting Us. Sun Goddess Scents. Sun Goddess Scents, your one-stop natural shop located at 4140 Jonesboro Road in Forest Park, Georgia. Inside the International Discount Mall, booth 225. That's Sun Goddess Scents, your one-shop natural shop. Give our sister Shelly Amonset a call at 404-434-7963. That's 404-434-7963. Sun Goddess Scents, your one-stop natural shop. Sanjay Dash Aidi, Sister Gabby, is doing an outstanding job of providing education, health care, sustainable agriculture, and entrepreneurship in the northeastern part of the island of Haiti, up in the mountain areas. So give the sister support. Go to her website at Sanjay, Sonjay-Haiti, AYITI.org. Sanjay Dash Haiti. Akaban Institute. Baba Baruti and Mama Yah have been doing excellent work in raising our young warriors, and they need your support. Make a check or money order out to Akaban Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. But, of course, you can use PayPal and Cash App. For instance, if you got Cash App, put in a $ Yah, Y-A-A, the letter M, Baruti, B-A-R-U-T-I. And you can make an ongoing donation if you choose to do so. That would be greatly appreciated. Also, too, if you want the books, go to Akaban House, akabanhouse.com. You know, Baba Broody's a prolific writer, always good information. So go to Akaban House. So we're going to read from one of his books right now. The Inye Sasim of Daily. Revolutionary Thought, the Inye Sasim.
Sorry. June 10th. Our freedom of speech is freedom or death. We got to fight the powers that be. Public enemy, Chuck D. Warriors do not concern themselves with death. It comes with the territory. When inevitable, we charge a death. So if anything, given that serious Africans, should measure progress by how far they have moved themselves and assisted others in moving away from Urugu's way, warriors would be concerned with how well they're doing on the front line when death arrives. Because of those who do not already possess it, true warriorhood brings humility. Warriors should understand the current of cowardice that flows in the veins of those who live in fear and ignorance. Therefore, if they walk in righteousness, warriors cannot act as if stepping in and out of madness is okay and normal for those who aspire to warriorhood. It is impossible for those claiming African-centeredness to permanently raise above compromise and undisciplined way of Urugu's disciples. Living a life of defense of lies is not living. Neither is it maintaining. It is dying. So the message to our aspiring warriors would be to not allow the weakness of any one of those who claim to share the warrior's front line to cause you to question the strength in all of who we are. Lies weaken. Lies kill the warrior within, and even faster when one telling them comes to believe them. More importantly, lies indicate the presence of fear, and fear destroys one's constitution and the discipline to overcome fear. As the ancestors say, a lie is a child's way of escaping punishment, and age is no detriment of maturity in Urugu's reality. If there are no more lies, there is no fear. Ashe. Affirm, I fight the powers that be. Affirm, I fight the powers that be. June 11th, our education must therefore inoculate a sense of commitment to the total community and help the pupils to accept the values appropriate to our kind of future. Julius Nyerere of Tanzania. A community reveals itself in crises, although its circumstances may vary. Its heart does not change. Therefore, we must see it for what it is, and what we see with each in every crisis in an African community is a momentary reactive escalation in our efforts to remove our children from educational institutions and personal selected and paid by Urugu to deconstruct any semblance of self-awareness and revolutionary consciousness in our children. These cyclical escalations speak volumes to both our unbroken awareness and that we are at war and genocidally assaulted, and the fact that our limited response has grown weaker and weaker over time. Each time we begin as if it's from scratch. Each time those who have already been doing this independent, sovereignty-focused work have to call out from the seemingly darkness to remind us of the pacifying state that mis- and diseducation has reduced us to. Each time they call us to awaken from a fear and ignorance for the sake of the children, and to begin to find the courage to brave the storm which will demonstrate our love for them and all African people forever. Each time they ask to reveal ourselves unto ourselves so we can see each crisis, regardless of circumstances, for what it is, a struggle with the potential to release us from our enslavement and return ourselves home. Our struggle to permanently liberate our children's minds should be That's a tough word, eglomatic. Each escalation should be built on the previous one, not repeatedly starting if nothing meaningful work has preceded it. We must continue to work and build on what has been done. Affirm, I teach accountability. Affirm, I teach accountability. June 12th, what can we do to help our people become strong? Queen Mother Injiri. We can set the standard for which it means to be African by applying the wisdom of our ancestors. We can be the model of accountability and non-contradictions when it comes to our community's interests. We can take the chances which allow for gradual redevelopment of trust among us. We can show them the God within through guiding them in through the challenges of being warriors. We can be righteous and humble in everything we think, speak, and do. We can create or join the type of security force we need to solve our internal issues and confront enemy forces. We can support these businesses, organizations, and efforts which uncompromisingly express revolution, sovereignty-seeking politics, and nation-building relationships. We can confront deicide, the killing of the God within. To murder God is to murder us and our movement. Our mission statement for helping our people become strong is not complicated. All we need to do is find like minds, build sacred spaces, and protect them with our lives. Affirm, I model strength. Affirm, I model strength. The Inye Sesim of Daily Revolutionary Thought.
My guest is here, and before I talk to my guest, I want to make, I just got information right before I came on that a very dear friend of mine in Milwaukee, a very good friend of mine, has made his transition. Brother Ernie G, Ernie Mitchell. Ernie G was a local DJ, first on radio station WNOV 860. Then on W1290 MCS before it went off, and then back to WNOV again before he was ill and he had been off the radio for a couple of years. And last I talked to him was before the holidays, which was last year. And I was thinking about him. I'm serious. I was thinking about him a lot these last couple of days. And I know for sometimes when you think that way, you kind of feel bad because you wish you would have called. Maybe I could have said something to him. Not that he would not have passed, no, but at least I know that I would have spoken to him before he made his transition. Because he was a good man, a good brother. Did a lot. You know, we worked together on a number of projects. The North Lincoln Alumni Game, the Open Hill football game, although he didn't play because he was kind of small dude, but his promotion of it and a number of other projects that me and Ernie G worked together. And of course, many times with the Black Firefighters, our dances and so forth, he would DJ. And just a good brother, real good brother. You'll be tremendously missed. Ernie G, I love you, my man. You'll be tremendously missed. I want to continue the conversation on the Tulsa massacre. One of the persons, when I went to Tulsa back in January of 2020, last year, almost a year and a half ago, I was impressed by the brother who gave us the real tour of Greenwood, Black Wall Street, and that is Brother Chief Eagle Mawali. You've probably seen him. He was in the documentary, the one that was produced by Russell Westbrook. I played that particular piece that he's on the program last week. I've seen so many of the documentaries. Hopefully that you have too, that you're well aware of the Tulsa situation and what needs to be done today. I went to Tulsa last week, as many of you know, and I did get a chance to really talk and see Chief. He was very busy. And I know this brother is his heart and he's sincere. And especially he also was the ceremony that they had, the I'm trying to keep it together here. The memorial ceremony that they had for the deceased of Greenwood and the three survivors that were there. That was beautiful. I sent that out. Somebody sent it to me. Oh, I know who sent it to me. My good brother, Brother Lusk sent it to me. Brother Theodore Lusk sent it to me. And I sent it out to a number of people so you can get a chance to hear from the people right there who are doing the work in Tulsa. Let me introduce you to Brother Chief Igumanwali. Chief, how are you?
I'm supreme. How are you, brother?
I'm doing well, thank you. How's your wife? How's she doing?
She's under anesthesia right now, going through the process.
All right, all prayers. All prayers that everything is all right and will. So, you know, this past week, I know it was a very hectic, very busy week for you and the people and brothers and sisters in the city of Tulsa, you know, with people coming from all over the world, literally. And many of our people coming there, hopefully maybe like myself, wanting to support the people of Tulsa in a resolution for what they have gone through. And that revolution, that resolution should be reparations. There should be some kind of compensation. There'd be something that initially said that's going to be done. Because only thing that's really left, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, I know you got the center, which is across the street from Vernon AME Church. You know, you got the Greenwood Center. And then right after the rail, right after the highway, the interstate, in the underpass, you have, you know, that block of businesses on both sides of the street. And, you know, I'm not sure of anything else besides that. If there is, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're accurate. The only surviving edifices in Greenwood were the basement of Vernon AME Church and the basement of Mount Zion Church.
Wow. And I know that I've seen the pastor of Vernon when he found out about it. And, of course, you know, it was moving. That the only thing, and because the church itself was built right on top of what had existed previously, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
And that basement provided a lot of protection for a lot of people. I know.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, there was one thing that I found, and that is there was a article in Your Black World, dated the 7th, and the article dealt with the survivors getting $300,000, $100,000 apiece for the three survivors. And that was coming from the Greenwood Foundation, didn't, from the Justice for Greenwood Foundation.
Yes, sir.
And I know that's not really, you know, justice, but it is definitely something as a true acknowledgement to their suffering and the devastation that it caused them and their families, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that probably the real satisfaction is to know that the city of Greenwood, the state of Oklahoma, who are responsible for what happened and who taken no responsibility, who don't even want to discuss the idea of reparations. You know, I remember when this thing came to light back in the 90s for me. I was watching Nightline, they were talking about it, and there was a state legislator who was adamant. He didn't want to give a dime. He said, okay, maybe I'll give a plaque, just something to recognize it. But no, I don't want to give nothing.
No. Of course.
Yeah, I don't want to give a dime to this, you know, not the state's money. But, you know, it was the state. It was the city. It was the government. You know, when the sheriff deputized all of those Caucasian men, giving them the right to kill any and every black person that they saw. It was sanctioned by that. And that's murder. Right. And there's no statute of limitations to murder. So when they talk about, well, no, you can't make these claims because that was so far along, so far ago. But the deal is, and you can correct me once again if I'm wrong, y'all got the documentation of who was who, where was where, and what was gone, what was stolen, what was destroyed. Y'all got the documentation.
Yeah, absolutely. And every insurance policy that was filed, you know, that's how they were able to have a guesstimate about the degree of property damage. Like recently, the Harvard Gazette made, you know, upgraded. That's a matter of perception, but they upgraded the amount of damages to exceed $600 million in today's numbers.
Wow, $600 million in today's yep. money, $600 million yes. dollars.
That's right,
man. And then when you look at Black Wall Street, the Greenwood, Archer, and Pine District, which of course the Gap Band took its initials from, the Gap Band is Greenwood, Archer, and
That's
Pine.
That's right. That's right.
You know, and their famous song, which was a sad reality, "You Dropped a Bomb on Me."
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yep.
You dropped it because it was the first time, aside from Philadelphia, when in the Osage community in Philadelphia, a bomb was dropped on them in 1985. So this country is not, you know, it'll drop a bomb on your ass, particularly if it's a Black community. They'll drop a bomb on you. Man.
Yep.
So
that's right.
So then for all those many years, I know that Europeans, Caucasian whites, struck fear in the people in Oklahoma, intimidating them from not even discussing it, not even talking about it. Don't even, you know, but the courage happened in the 80s, I believe, when a good number of the survivors who were still living, who were still very cognizant of what happened, began to tell their stories. I think
that's correct. It was actually the 90s.
Oh, okay.
And when that happened, but a lot of, you know, those people who were children during that time period and those who carried the legacy of trauma that their parents and grandparents and siblings went through, they all came, you know, we created a safe space. And my grandfather was one of those people. And, you know, they took the opportunity to say, okay, you know what? It's time for us to have courage to do what should have been done a long time ago.
I say.
But the fear was that we would be so incensed and so angry. And we were, most of us who found out during that time, that many of us had relatives and family friends who were survivors of you know, this terrorist attack, this Holocaust. The impact was tremendous. It reignited some stuff that we, you know, we started to look at and say, man, you know, I started to look at the fact that I went to Booker T. Washington High School in Tulsa. That's, you know, where the gifted and talented would attend school. You had to get accepted to get in there.
I remember thinking,
man, I can't wait to get out of high school. Black people haven't done nothing in Oklahoma. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to go to Atlanta or D.C. or Dallas, somewhere, anywhere where Black folks are doing things. You know what I'm saying? And uh-huh. so I thought about how traumatic that was for me as a young man. Just feeling like
you have no future.
To take Oklahoma history.
Right. You have no future. But, no, yeah.
Yes. But the legacy of what we built, it's had I known. Right. The degree of how that would have ignited this idea of pioneering, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And reinventing myself and my identity.
Yeah. But now, see, they try to make it seem like, you know, they wanted to wash it away, just like they wanted to wash away many of the other massacres that they have done. Rosewood,
right.
They wiped Rosewood off the map. You couldn't even find Rosewood until a survivor told those stories. You know, one of the things that really bothers me about all of this is that we're dealing with a people, and that's what makes me somewhat disappointed to degree that now I know the history and I know how they are and I know how we are, but just to see us challenge critical race theory, to see us challenge 1619 and decide with Caucasians is just sickening. But that is the history, man. That is the history. And I'm quite sure there's more. In fact, I just seen a piece where some Negro is talking about he doesn't believe that this Rosewood, he doesn't believe in Black Wall Street. He doesn't believe what happened with Dick Rowland and what happened in that elevator at that time, you know, because he said he doesn't think that's what happened. But the bottom line is, it is what happened. The evidence
you know
is
what?
There.
Even if that had not happened, right, let's just pretend for a moment that it's untrue, right? The evidence that this thing was pre-planned and orchestrated is very much real, right? So if the person, if any persons don't want to believe that reality, there's enough evidence to show you that the whole thing was going to happen anyway, whether that happened with Dick Rowland or Sarah Page or not.
That's right.
Right? Because these folks, after the massacre, they held civil court. And folks started testifying. In fact, the police chief and the police, the sheriff were indicted. Nothing came of it, but they were both indicted. So you got all of these. I love naysayers, and because I love to debunk fools, right? And so the truth of the matter is that incident was going to happen anyway.
Yes, yes.
How do you have a city that has declared martial law, and within 5 days after the massacre, you already have devised a plan to take an organization, the Tulsa Real Estate Exchange, and you put together a completely comprehensive plan for ethnic cleansing to take the land that those people lived on during martial law? I don't think so.
Yeah.
That whole element was pre-planned.
No doubt.
I have deed records where people started buying land as early as January 3rd in the Greenwood District.
Man. Devastated that community.
The thing was methodical. It was very methodical.
And that's like that with all the others. They give the pretense of some brother costing a white woman.
Yeah,
you know, mm-hmm. and then use that mm-hmm. to destroy the vamp on community and destroy them. You know,
yeah. you want to ignite the dynamite, so you have somebody to blame after.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they blamed us for destroying our own community. It was our fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's right. Anytime there's a so-called riot.
Yeah, it's
look
our
at last
fault.
Summer. Look at last summer, mm-hmm. but then look at how many white supremacists were arrested for inciting provocateurs that mm-hmm. were arrested for causing property damage during the so-called riots of last summer.
Right. You have many people in either they were in Antifa or they were just provocateurs. They were there just to start
That's
some
right.
stuff. Because there was this
That's
one.
Right.
I saw this one sister. She was saying. Because, you know, the Caucasian girl, you could see she was Caucasian, and she was spraying mm-hmm. BLM, F the police, this and that. She was like, sister was like, hey, wait a minute. What y'all mm-hmm. doing? This mm-hmm. is our community.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Be putting this stuff up here. Caught her red handed.
Right.
Then, of course, it was stated that they put bricks and so forth. A pallet of bricks that these people could go get and start throwing them at businesses and breaking, busting windows and so forth. I mean, this stuff it was orchestrated, you know? And of course, to make the whole thing look bad and make us look bad.
Of course.
To make us look bad.
Of course. Because the narrative after the massacre was that these people are the cause of the destruction of Greenwood. That was the media narrative, right? So you had to produce, you had to fabricate, manufacture all the elements to put that in place. And when you control the media, that's easy.
Yeah.
You know, most people don't know that the governor himself put a gag order on all media outlets in Tulsa in 1923, 2 years after the massacre, because the Klan rhetoric was so rancid. And they were actually controlling politics on every level, regardless of party.
Yeah, I tell you, it doesn't amaze me. I know it probably surprises some others, and it really shouldn't, you know, because I put nothing past these folks to do whatever they feel they have to do to maintain their dominance, their privilege, you know, that they created for themselves. I put nothing past them. And these people are selfish. They're greedy. They don't want to share. They're mean-spirited. They're evil. I don't trust them. I don't trust this system, you know. In fact, if they say the sky is blue, hell, I think I'm saying it's green. I don't even want to go along to get along with anything. I'm at a point right now, Chief, you know, I wish I could fly away, man. I wish I could go ahead and make this repatriation move. But I also,
I'm right with you. I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
Man.
But I also.
You know, we just happen to be those Harriet Tubmans. We have to keep going back
right.
to the plantation, grabbing folks. Cause, yep. Because wherever we're going, we're going to need a big collective of us.
Right.
Of the same mindset.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Like-minded people. Yes.
Yeah. Like-minded people, you know, mm-hmm. who want to be free. Mm-hmm. Like you, that's the qualification. Do you want to get free? And what are you willing to do to get free?
Yep. Cause I'm going to tell you,
you know, I think one thing that, what may surprise people that we didn't discuss the last time you were in Tulsa and we did the tour, I made some discoveries. You know, I'm a board member for the Center for Public Secrets, and I encourage, you know, your members to go and look at the information. We put together a pamphlet called The Architects of the Massacre. So we're basically naming and identifying the responsible parties.
Okay. Architects of the Massacre. Is that a website?
Yes, it is. The Center for Public Secrets. You can Google it.
Okay,
we have a website
for public.
Yeah, we have a web Center for Public Secrets.
Secrets, okay.
Yeah, we have a website and a brick and mortar building.
Okay.
That people can, you know, when they come to town, they go, you know, check out the Center for Public Secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually published a booklet so that people would have documentation. But one of the things I discovered that I didn't know, you know, because I said, you know what, I need to really look through more of these. You know, when everybody who's read books about the massacre or seen stories, the only references they give you are white media references,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the only thing that anybody ever shows you, whether you go to a university institution or whatever, you always see those references. Nobody, like, you got 50 black towns in Oklahoma during that time.
Right.
Why is it nobody did any real hardcore research in black publications?
Right.
So I actually went and started doing that. And I want to explain to listeners the truth as to why Greenwood burned when it did. Greenwood burned the way it did because we not just had financial power and independency and land in a prime real estate area, but in March of 1920, Stratford and Smitherman, A.J. Smitherman with the Tulsa Star.
Right, he was a newspaper brother. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He started a campaign to get black folks to convert from Republican to Democrat. He did it because the Ku Klux Klan and the powers that be, so-called powers that be, dominated the Democratic Party.
Right.
And they were saying all the influence and power is in the Democratic Party. So what if we took over the party and created our own ticket for the city of Tulsa?
Mm.
Brother, let me tell you, in 1 month, they took over the Democratic Party.
Wow, they did it. They organized and did it. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
They organized their own ticket from the mayor down to the smallest commissioner. So by April of 1920, when they got ready to vote, you had a few handkerchief heads who basically, you know, rallied against the cry for the takeover,
mm-hmm.
right? They were like, look, we're not here to compromise. If we're going to do some revolutionary activity, let's take over the party that belonged to the Klan.
Right on.
Wow. Right? And mm-hmm. they did. Let me tell you, when they had the election, they only lost by 205 votes. That's it.
Mm.
205 votes. Now, what listeners need to understand is this. You can have financial power, but you cannot have political power.
Mm-hmm.
And they almost took it in less than a month. The whole city. With the rate that Greenwood was growing, the rate, the population growth in Greenwood and the economic growth in Greenwood, at the rate that it was going, by that next election, it was going to be a landslide.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people were coming to Greenwood from across the country, us, because of financial
absolutely.
Opportunities and jobs and so forth, a better standard of living. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, The rate in which Greenwood was growing was ridiculous,
mm.
right? That incubator, that pool that people created was unparalleled. You know, like people say, a lot of these places developed due to Jim Crow. That's a falsity in Tulsa, particularly, because Oklahoma, Tulsa specifically, Oklahoma, that area of Greenwood, of Oklahoma itself, already had 27 black towns pre-Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so most narratives say we were forced to spend amongst each other. No, we weren't. That was our preference. That was our desire.
Right on.
To spend with each other. Cooperative economics was a pleasure.
That's right. That's right. Hello.
Right? Not something we were forced to do, but every narrative, every author who's written a book would tell you, and even some of these documentaries, they'll say, well, you know, black folks were forced to spend with each other because of Jim Crow. That's a bunch of bull.
No, because you
27
had
27 black towns.
Yeah, because you had everything. You were self-contained. Yeah. You had all that you needed within
That's right.
You had all that you needed. You didn't have to go outside of there. I would be That's happy right. to spend with my
That's
people.
Right.
You know?
So Jim Crow was an unintended stimulus plan.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They thought it was going to punish us. But in fact, all it did was stimulate our growth.
Yeah.
Because we're like, fine, no problem. That we'll lean more on these other towns. Mm-hmm. So between statehood, 1907 and 1921, we went from 27 to over 50 black towns.
Wow.
Exactly.
And I know Boley, Oklahoma was one of the first towns.
Right.
You know, in that they mentioned when, you know, coming after the Trail of Tears.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know there were many others. And
yes, indeed.
And I think Boley, Oklahoma is still in existence.
It is. Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Is it just hanging mm-hmm. on, or is it decent town?
Boley has done. It's been doing quite a few improvements. You know, there's a black mayor's. They had a black mayor's conference, and they get together and talk about development. And I know a brother named Mayor Jack Sims, who's working with them, and they're talking about, you know, developing some eco plans, you know, to make utilize the land in these towns, you know, to make them more self-sustaining as far as energy and, you know, producing electricity and things of that nature.
Great, great. And, of course, mm-hmm. they're doing it collectively with the other black towns.
Right.
Outstanding. Because mm-hmm. that's what we must do, you know.
Yeah, we have to.
We are. That's who we are as a people. We're a collective people. Individualism mm-hmm. is a European Caucasian desire, I think, for therefore I am, you know. But collectivism mm-hmm. is an African imperative. It is a must. That's who we are. That's how we build, you know, through being collective. And you can see once, you know, the brothers and sisters begin to get the money, the oil residuals from that, and they began to build amongst themselves.
That's right.
And there were men who also came there, you know, because they probably couldn't do it in any other places. They said, look, Tulsa is growing. You know, J.B. Stafford and the others, they came there. He built that hotel. And I remember mm-hmm. reading saying that, you know, he was guarding his hotel. And so they coerced him to come out, and they told him that mm-hmm. they weren't going to destroy his hotel. And, of course, they lied, as always.
They lied. Yeah, and some people paid for it because of the greed. Three white men died inside the hotel while they were robbing it.
Good.
And it was on fire.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what you deal with. And that's what I tell people. If we don't get justice in Greenwood, in Tulsa, the city of Tulsa don't get nothing either.
Yeah.
And that's why the size of the city of Tulsa really hasn't grown. You got taller buildings, but it hasn't grown.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't gain, you don't gain.
That's right.
So they're going to carry that with them. You know, recently, you know, I'm on the Mass Graves Oversight Committee.
Okay.
We just discovered 7 children. We went from 12 from a few months ago to 27.
27?
As of yesterday.
27 individuals or 27 mass graves?
27 individuals in the mass grave location.
Mass grave. Okay. Okay.
And amongst them are 7 children.
Well, there had to be more than what was it? What did the city and the state of Oklahoma say? It was only 37 of us who had died, something like that.
Yeah, the original number was 37.
36. 36.
And then it went from 36 to 100. Then the estimate went from 100 to 300. My question is, who is the number keeper?
Yeah.
Where are the receipts? Who's calculating these numbers? Mm-hmm. Because whoever is calculating these numbers knows the truth.
Right. Well, listen, we're going to take
a break.
We're going to take a break. I'm glad that you're here with us, man. I appreciate this. I know what you're going through, you know, so I appreciate you taking this time out to do this, to inform the brothers and sisters who are listening and those who will call in on just kind of a wrap up on what's happening in Tulsa. And believe me, there's going to be more things that are happening and to be talked about and discussed with Tulsa because they need justice. They deserve justice. Something good can happen. It must happen in Tulsa. Brothers and sisters, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. You stay with us. We'll be right back.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Yeah.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. So Makusa, 1972 or 73, somewhere around there with Manu Dibanga. Manu Dibanga made his transition last year. Unfortunately, he passed from COVID. Manu Dibanga, So Makusa. We're having our conversation today with Chief Ikumawali, a brother who is who I've been very impressed with when he gave us the tour last year in January of 2020 in an effort to encourage many people to come to Tulsa to witness the commemoration to support the people and brothers and sisters in Tulsa. It became interesting that there was some fractions, there was some divisions in our community, as there always is, because we're dealing with white folks. They are always into divide and conquer. And that situation happened in Tulsa as well. I know there's a museum they're building, the Tulsa Rising, that to deal with the massacre. I know that was funded by, most of the funding was by, basically, from what I heard, I could be wrong, European Jews who put up a lot of the funding.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And of course, then the issue became you found $30 million to build this, Tulsa Rising Museum, but you found nothing. Got a little background noise there. Thank you. But you found $30 million, but you couldn't find anything for the survivors, nor for the descendants, or for the community, or for anything to say, we're going to expand that one block of Greenwood for other businesses. Maybe, that's it, And so nothing was done. So, there was supposed to have been a concert by John Legend and Stacey Abrams, who was very instrumental here in Georgia of getting out to vote in the 2020 elections to turn Georgia from being, red to blue. And what was interesting is that the two men who are now U.S. senators at the time, probably people thought they didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning. And both of those men won that election through her efforts, because one of the main organizations is Black Votes Matter. Black Votes Matter went out into the rural area. See, just like in Oklahoma, same thing here in Georgia. Now, I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It ain't like that in Wisconsin. We're in a specific area in the southeastern portion of the state of Wisconsin. That's pretty much central where we are. But here in Georgia, probably in Oklahoma, we're all over the place, And because of intimidation and so forth, many of our people didn't vote, didn't feel they had the right need to vote or even have the right to vote. But the work of Stacey Abrams and all those people involved, they got that vote out, and that's why, and that's how Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff won those two Senate seats, and that put the Senate at 50% where Kamala Harris has a deciding vote,
That's right. A
whole different dynamic. And so, and then because of that, and even though, as you know, all of these states had all of these recalls, all these states looked at all how the voting was done and so forth, and all of them said there were no irregularities. It was fair. It happened. And yet, all of these Republicans are enacting and voting into all of these draconian, restrictive voting laws.
Yeah. Yeah.
It further substantiates to me,
I don't give a damn who you are, what you say. We run this, and this is how we want this. Even though the Republican Party cannot win a general election because of how they are and who they are and what they stand for, they can't do it. So they develop all of these ideas and voting, you know, restrictive voting measures and antiquated voting measures, and they're winning that. They're being passed through the state, yeah, and they're winning that. They won't win the elections. Because to me, if I was a voting person, and I ain't, but if I was, you know, I make sure that I could make sure that my vote and the people that I work with were able to vote on election day, just to make sure that, you know, we get our people in, you know.
Indeed.
But I mean, so that didn't come off. And who was that supposed to benefit, that John Legend concert and...
Well, it would have benefited the same, you know, Jewish organization that sponsored them coming, along with the Race Riots Centennial Commission. You know, I have this joke, and it's not really a joke, but I have this satire expression, and I tell people, you know, in Tulsa, the auction block is hot, right? And it don't matter your political party. They didn't figure out we can buy a Democrat.
Yeah.
Especially a good black one, put enough money in his pocket.
Yeah,
you already know the odds are stacked against him, so let's just go and purchase him, and we'll make it look like, because ego is a monster, we'll let it look like it's his idea.
Right.
Right. So gentrification by blackface.
D-S-D.
So that whole that right there. Mm-hmm. So that whole idea, you know, and people need to understand this whole thing with the commission. This isn't something just popped up. We started having these meetings a couple of years ago, asking what kind of comprehensive plan are you going to put in place as you leverage the trauma and pain of these living survivors who have gotten no justice, right? How do you do that? How do you put a tombstone on top of them before they die? Because that's what that symbolizes, right? Mm-hmm. It has potential to be something different. But if you can't be innovative enough, human enough, right, African enough to understand our concepts and how we think and how we should think, how we should exist, then we way off, we're not going to let that happen, right?
Good.
Tulsa's still full of fighters.
Right on.
You know, regardless, and it's not, and I like to say it's not really factions. It's us versus them.
Yeah.
Because that's what they choose. They don't choose to be unified. They don't choose collectiveness. They choose individuality, right? They buy in individuals, not communities. They buy up communities, but they don't. This is a whole different thing here. It's the survivors versus them. Mm. It's the descendants versus them. It's injustice versus justice. So they just think that it's like, you pick a side. What side of history you want to be on? What side of justice you want to be on? Right? This is non-negotiable. It shouldn't even be questionable. How do you tell a 107-year-old survivor? You can't use the same excuses you use for H.R. 40, right? The reparations study bill. You can't use that same excuse. Well, there are no living survivors and nobody was around you. You know, this is a different case here. You can, the local mayor here says, I don't believe reparations can happen in Tulsa. It's too divisive. And I don't think we should, the people of today should pay for the sins of the past. And I said, so what you're saying is you don't think that the living survivors today should be paid for the sins of the past, right? It's all about how they play the word games with semantics, mm-hmm, and how we listen to that language and we let them stipulate how we comprehend what's actually being said. We almost have to have a Euro translator, right? When we have these conversations,
that's right, all that, all,
unpack.
Yeah, all that, yeah, double speak.
Mm-hmm, and decode that stuff, yeah, right? Like, okay, so what he's saying is this, right? And so it just don't get no different. You know, it's like my brother, he got, you know, unfortunately he's in the penitentiary, but he called me when the president came and he said, why was you mean mugging the president? I saw you in the video. And I said, you know, when I wasn't even conscious of my body language, I just knew that
it was full of shit.
You got an opportunity. You have an opportunity today. They might not have tomorrow. You have an opportunity today to say what needs to be said. Mm-hmm. Right? And it didn't happen.
Right. Right.
So people, I'm watching all of my people in this room, and I'm looking at all of the hype, and I'm looking at all of these successful, well, you know what? I'm not going to use the word successful. I'm looking at these upwardly mobile Black folks who found themselves in positions that elevate themselves based on our experiences as Black people. And so I'm witnessing all of this, and I'm thinking, wow, there's so much influence in this room. There is no reason we shouldn't be, there shouldn't be a collective movement right now with everybody in this space, Roland Martin, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, everybody in the space, mm-hmm. right? Like, that should have been a unanimous outcome. It should have been a press conference after the president did not use the word reparations.
Right.
They should have had a press conference immediately, collectively saying, we demand reparations right now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We went to Congress 3 weeks ago.
Right.
And made the same demands.
Right.
Right? Sheila Jackson Lee pointedly said, Mr. Mayor, hear me now.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta do right by these survivors.
Right. See, unlike
I'm looking for the outcry. Like, what's going on here? What are we here? This is a photo op. You know, like, help me understand why you didn't haul these survivors out. 107-year-old. I wish that was my mama. You gonna bring my 107-year-old mama out to listen to you? What? Congratulate me because I survived. No. That's unacceptable. It's unacceptable. That's why we got to take care of us.
That's right.
That's why Justice Greenwood said, we'll get them $100,000 each. Flowers while you live. But that, man, the game. And, you know, Johnny Cochran said, I worked his security when him and Professor Ogletree were managing the case for my grandfather and the other 200-plus survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And we were backstage, and I asked him. You know, I wasn't as aware as I am now. But I asked Johnny Cochran. I said, "So tell me what this means to you." He said, "Brother, we win Tulsa. We win every state in the union because Tulsa is H.R. 40.
Right.
Tulsa is the study.
Yeah."
Of H.R. 40. You can literally take Tulsa and look at the long-term effects, because you're talking about a city that built something unparalleled, number one, economically and politically.
Right.
Number two, rebuilt to 85% in 4 years. You're talking about a state that had more millionaires in 1921 than we do now. How do you, like, man... We were looking at a modern day Wakanda, and oil was vibranium.
Right. Right. And like I said, one of the brothers who I can't remember what his name was, but he had a movie camera at the time, and he documented physically, visually, showing brothers and sisters in the city of Tulsa and how they were living and the cars they had and so forth. You know, the homes, the beautiful homes they had. Mm-hmm. You know. I mean,
Sir Solomon Jones, that was his name.
Okay.
Yep, Sir Solomon Jones.
See, so the documentation is there. That's the point. Everything is right there to let you know who lived here, what they had, what was done to them, you know? And and then somebody said to me, she said, well, I thought the last surviving member had died some time ago. So who are these people? I said, listen, man, you probably still have somebody as old as Mother Fletcher living someplace else, because when that whole thing went down, people left. Some people did not come back. They did not come back.
That's right.
But that memory is still there about what happened.
That's right.
And even if they were coming out of there as a child,
They told that to their kids when they got older and so forth and so on. They kept that they kept that situation alive through conversations, through documentation. It's there. And that's so when these three people came up, I wouldn't question whether or not that they were not survivors of Tulsa like some people have. That's crazy as far as I'm concerned.
I'll tell you how crazy it is. My grandfather is a survivor. My great uncle and aunt were survivors. I didn't even know. I had already been part of the movement for justice in 97. I didn't know that they were even part of it until 2003 when my grandfather became a plaintiff.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that information, you know, you brothers and sisters in Tulsa did an outstanding job of making sure that, you know, those lives would not be in vain. Although, of course, the city of Tulsa, the state of Oklahoma, and the government of the United Snakes would not recognize and always suppress the legitimate legal claims of black people, of African people, American African people, will constantly do that. It is their history. It is what they have done. There is no shame to these folks at all. There is no conscience. Not collectively.
Nope.
There might be somebody, right. There might be an individual here or there. Because I know, like, me as a child, remembering hearing about this brother named Daniel Bell who got killed. And actually, he was killed by a police officer who planted a knife on him so he could, you know, after he had killed him, you know. Well, his partner was dying. The guy who seen it happen. He was dying. And he said, I could not. This was on 60 Minutes. This is on 60 Minutes.
Right.
Daniel Bell case here in Milwaukee. He said, I don't want to go to the grave with this. I want to clear my conscience. Wow. And the dude that did it was still living. And of course, there are no statute of limitations on murder. So they arrested him. And I don't know, they let him live the last few, because he was like about 70 something at the time. You know, this is the 80s, you know? And so,
yes.
But these individuals, whatever, I ain't talking about a little few individuals here and there. I'm talking about the collective mindset of Europeans who have a disdain for African people and have shown that consistently, particularly in this country, were not giving us our due respect and giving us, you know, the justice that is so definitely deserved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I listened to Sheila Jackson Lee in at the center, at the Greenwood Center. They had the first panel discussion was Lee Merritt and Crump, you know, about...
Yeah, I was on that one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know. And then the next panel was with narrated by Tiffany Cross, and it had the brother attorney, Simmons.
Right.
And Sheila Jackson Lee and Tori, what's the name from St. Louis? Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Tori.
Yeah.
Corey Bush from... Mm-hmm. And then had the brother, too, from Color of Change. And Color of Change, brothers and sisters, they're also the ones that help raise the money, the $300,000, to give $100,000 to each of those three survivors. You know, that organization did that as well. And you know, and I am a staunch believer in reparations. I've been a member of NCOBRA. For many years, from back in the 80s, late 80s, I've been an advocate for reparations, but I also understand this society, you know, and the people that we're dealing with. Brothers and sisters, I see a number of us here on the queue. If you want to get in this conversation, I hope that you do. We're talking with Brother Chief Ugumawali of Tulsa, Oklahoma. You hit star twice. Hit star twice and you can get in and give your comment, question, or concerns. If not, if you're on, you're listening, dial 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. And I've been that staunch, you know, proponent of reparations, because to me, not to seek reparations from these folks who have done
such heinous things to our people does a dishonor and a disservice to our people who suffer tremendously. And I know there's a bunch of handkerchief heads and Negroes talking about, we don't need reparations. We should be thankful that white folks came and got us so we could be here in America, you know, and all the great opportunities that we have here. You know, we should not seek, because reparations, as just as the mayor said, this is too divisive.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they say, well, how much could it be? I remember, man, and I've said this many times on this program, when we started talking seriously about reparations, there's a Caucasian who was a columnist. He passed. Good. Mm-hmm. Charles Cutheimer, conservative columnist. And yeah. So I got a couple people. Let me get to you in a second, brother. He said, okay, we gave him affirmative action. We gave him welfare. We gave him this. Let's give him reparations. Let's give them reparations. Let's say 40,000 a family, 20,000 an individual. And then once that's done, it's over. Well, there is no more whining and crying about anything. We done paid you off. And the burden of proof for you to on discrimination is on you. There is no more class actions. There's none of that. It's on you. And if you can't come with corroborated evidence that you have been discriminated, we're kicking it out. Because now mm-hmm. We done paid off everything. This was his mindset. And believe me, mm-hmm. there's a lot of folks that that would happen. 414-507, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Brother Oshie.
Hey, what's happening, LaRue?
This is a good one. Yeah, I was talking to some people. They've been showing about Greenwood and on the news and on TV, and I'm talking to people, man, who never heard of it until now. I'm like, this is because we don't have our own institutions to educate us about our history and our philosophies and our cultures, but. This is a more of a statement, but when I came to Milwaukee, I saw the aftermath of all the businesses that black people had going up Martin Luther King Avenue,
right,
which is called Thurman Inn, right, and on North Avenue. And now they dropped one of them kind of bombs that don't destroy property, but it takes everything away.
Yeah.
And so what happened in Oklahoma was direct in our front. But I think when we look at that and we look at where we are today in terms of our communities and businesses and our economic base and where our money's going, We see the lesson being repeated over and over again. And yeah. So anyway, brother's doing a good job. I'm very enlightened of what he's saying.
Oh yeah, he's the deal. No doubt. Yeah, Chief Ugamawali, like I said, I was deeply impressed with him in the tour that he gave. Helped me clearly understand what was happening in Tulsa, and of course, some of the things that were going to happen that would not benefit the people of Tulsa. And I'm appreciative for that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would like to address what he's saying while he's on the call. You know, one of the things that people need to understand about Tulsa is this wasn't mob violence. This was state and federally sanctioned mm-hmm. murder,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you got your National Guard involved as your federal entity. You got your state police, your local police involved, that state and city sanctioned mm-hmm. murder, genocide. So you're not gonna put this in a historical context, right? Because it doesn't work that way. You cover it up and you have all of your legal institutions or entities participating in a very thorough cover up. On top of that, you recruit thousands more than in Oklahoma alone. There were more Klansmen in Oklahoma than anywhere in the Union after the massacre. The recruitment of Klansmen was so intense. So throughout the year of 1922, They spent the majority of that year terrorizing black folks, kidnapped. They had this thing called kidnapping and whipping parties. This was to ensure that there would not be an insurrection, right? That there wouldn't be revenge. That's what people don't know. Mount Zion Church, the pastor of Mount Zion Church, when they rebuilt in 1953, the pastor said, we're going to use steel beams to rebuild our church so that it won't be bombed again. That means that man in 1953 was still thinking about the possibility of being bombed again. Mm-hmm. That's how traumatizing it was, right? So those families were never going to speak about it because they knew that they were behind. You in a police state. Mm-hmm. I know black folks who suffer on the job and don't say nothing. Imagine when you, when your whole community been terrorized. After you successfully defended it, that's the reason you had to bomb it, because those people in Greenwood were actually effectively defending Greenwood. All them World War I veterans who came back from World War I, yep. they effectively defended Greenwood on May 31st until midnight, and a ceasefire occurred. After the ceasefire, between midnight and 5 a.m., the local National Guard and the city of Tulsa regrouped, surrounded Greenwood, cut the telegraph line so they could not call for reinforcements. See, in Tulsa, you had the African Blood Brotherhood, which was a military organization. Yes, a military organization that defended Greenwood. They were established in New York City. That's where the African Blood Brotherhood was established. They had their own chapter in Tulsa. And those brothers defended Greenwood.
Wow.
That's why they had to take to the sky.
Yeah.
Because they could not defeat these warriors on the ground.
Wow, that's deep. And brothers and sisters, I hope you heard that, because the perception has been is that we really didn't, you know, we were just getting vamped on. We didn't fight. No, we fought back, but we were outmanned and outgunned, especially when they started dropping those bombs on us. Wow, that's
right.
Deep. Oh, we got another caller. Caller 334. 334, good afternoon. Caller 334. 334, good afternoon. Okay, well, you can chime in whenever you get a chance.
Wait.
Hold up, here he is. All right, brother. Oh. All right, hey, brother, how you doing?
Hey, I'm sorry, I was on mute. I was on mute. Man, this is a fantastic conversation, and it's such a pleasure to be almost upfront and personal with Chief Umuwale.
Yes.
Did I pronounce it right? Sir,
yes.
Thank you so very much. And you know, this kind and type of conversation is what I had been looking for after the affair a few weeks ago, because I was always curious to know what happened in June, say June 15th, June 30th, then July of 1921, November of 1921. Do you understand where I'm going? What was going on after all of this had happened? And I thought I may have heard you say something referring to the Center for Public Secrets.
Yes, sir. That's an organization that I'm a board member of. We started it so that we could give some insight, some deep, detailed insight about who the architects of this event are, you know, who they are. Because you can't track, you can't say who's responsible if you don't do the research. You don't know who benefited from it, whose names are on street signs and institutions,
right?
And we wanted to expose that.
Brother, the question that also, and Brother Oshie had alluded to it, was the fact that I was often wonder about those who were part of that Ma'afa, those who transitioned from out of Tulsa to other parts of the country. Had there ever been any kind of tracking of sorts established for those people who were physical survivors and may have wound up, say, here in Alabama or in Louisiana or Mississippi to reestablish their lives at all that you may know of?
For the most part, those people who did track were people who pretty much had the resources and the wherewithal to reestablish somewhere else, right? People like J.B. Stratford and other members. Then you, later in 2003, There was some research done to try to track down as many people as they could who were descendants through descendants to find out what survivors, you know, where they went. Like my relatives, that my uncle Matthew, my great uncle Matthew was part of the fighting. So him and his wife changed their names and moved to L.A. But we didn't even know he moved to L.A. until 1930. Maybe, I know, actually 1940, right? Because they found him on some census records. But they had changed their name, and they gave birth to their fifth child, who most of you probably know as Stymie Beard on The Little Rascals.
Wow, Stymie.
Wait, so whoa. Well, I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry. Could you please repeat that one more time?
So my great uncle Matthew, he was my grandfather's surrogate parent. He left and went to L.A. because he was part of the fighting. Him and his family went to L.A. When they gave birth to their fifth child, who was Matthew Jr., that's who Stymie Beard is on the Little Rascals. Stymie Beard. What a little top hat.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stymie wore that derby.
Oh, man. Oh, you got to be kidding me. And Brother Oshie, this is why I love your program, because you bring the people up front and center. Man. Right. I would love to sit out and have coffee and shake hands with you, sir. Really. Yeah. Really, because these are the tidbits, brother, that we come across our elders each and every day. And we don't have the opportunity just to sit and have a small conversation with them. Just to talk. You never know who's in your presence. And right. it's amazing to be this close to you, who has an association with Tulsa, Oklahoma. The other question that I have is, what about Rentiesville? That's somewhat a little bit outside of Tulsa, isn't it? And it's also a black town. Do you know anything of Rentiesville, Oklahoma at all?
Yes, sir. In fact, Rentiesville and that area, that whole area, that would have been the Mecca place. That's where a lot of the pioneers in Greenwood came from.
Oh, wow.
You know, that's right. A.J. Smitherman. B.C. Franklin. Yeah, A.J. Smitherman with the Tulsa Star. They all came out of Muskogee, Rentiesville, all of those areas where they were Taft, where those small towns were located. Because that's where a lot of the black African freedmen went, you know, because the majority of black folks, see, Juneteenth in America is not the same Juneteenth for black folks in Oklahoma.
Is that right?
Our Juneteenth came 2 years after Juneteenth.
Okay, yours came in 1867?
That's right, because, see, you had over 20,000 Africans who were brought in on the Trail of Tears. with the five civilized tribes as slaves. So when they came to Oklahoma, and they had the 1866 treaty forced them to give land allotments to African people or make them full citizens. So they gave them land allotments. So that area that you're talking about is Creek land. So let's say you had a family of 12. Then the Creek had to give you and every member of your family 160 acres of land.
Wow.
Now, should you find oil on your land, then you would be like the 11-year-old millionaire, Sarah Rector.
Right, that young sister.
Right? And so she became wealthy because a land surveyor found land on a piece of property that her father leased. So she was the youngest millionaire in Tulsa County.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
It is.
Just unbelievable.
Well, listen, Brother Lush, you hang on, okay? If there are any other questions, hit again.
I most certainly will. Thank you.
You bet. And that's one of my good brothers, man, always listening.
Good thanks.
469. Good afternoon. 469.
Hey, Brother Oshie.
Good afternoon.
Chief. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to add on something to what the brother said, Chief. You know, I'll see you around. I don't know if you're going to be at the Black Genocide Memorial this Sunday or not.
I received the invitation. I won't be because I'll be caring for my wife. She's having surgery right now.
Okay. Well, we'll keep her in our prayers.
Thank you.
I actually had opportunity to go to lunch with some of the descendants from J.B. Stratford. And like the brother was asking, you know, a lot of people went to Chicago. You know, Chicago was a Mecca. Mm-hmm. But also, one of the descendants of his is John, Anyway, he's the CEO of Ariel Investments. So they had, what was interesting is within Tulsa, from my understanding, Chief, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Smitherman was a lawyer as well as J.B. Stratford.
That is correct.
And they were the rebellious one.
Mm-hmm.
B.C. Franklin, O.W. Gurley, they were, as I look at them, they kind of dealt with the establishment a little bit more than Smitherman and J.B. Stratford. J.B. Stratford, they weren't an eye for an, they were an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Whereas B.C. Franklin and O.W. Gurley, they tried to kind of work in between. Now, one of the things that they asked me, the descendants of J.P. Stratford's family, is why is Franklin so prominent? And I kind of explained to them, and correct me if I'm wrong, because of the analogy that I just gave. I say, look, you know, Stratford was a rebellion. Smitherman was a rebellion. They weren't going to put any statues or anything to uplift them, because J.P. Stratford, they had to get out of town. They had a bounty on their head. So, you know, they had that. Oh, by the way, the guy's name is John Rogers.
Okay.
John Rogers. Yeah, he's the CEO of Ariel Investment, and he's a descendant of J.P. Stratford. So that's all I'm going to say. Oh, one other thing, too, I do want to leave everyone with this. When you talk about Tulsa and the money people, you start off with George Kaiser. You'll see a lot of things with GFF, the founder, it's the foundation.
Yeah, George Kaiser Foundation.
Yeah, thank you.
Is that the Kaiser Aluminum people?
No, that's a different Kaiser.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that he's involved in that Greenwood Rising project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Gathering place. They have mm-hmm. also two chiefs. I just found out that this guy by the name of Moore, who owns a marketing company, the mm-hmm. Jazz Hall of Fame, they actually, the courts actually ruled in their favor. And they're
yeah, I read
actually,
that this morning.
Right. The guy that's the interim director right now is a guy by the name of C.J. Neal.
Yeah.
Do you
know
what
you're talking about? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I do.
Right. I hooked him up, gave him the number of a brother in St. Louis, because I'm from East St. Louis, a brother who's the CEO of Jazz St. Louis, on, you know, maybe giving some recommendations on, you know, funding. And hopefully they can hook up with this brother by the name of Dave Stewart, who is the owner of Worldwide Technology. And Dave Stewart is the second richest black person in the country. Mm. So
they've already sold the institution to a bidder today. The story came out today.
Yeah, oh, Moore.
And, yeah, uh-huh. And
yeah,
so,
I have.
But let me go back real quick, because I don't know how we are with time. Let me backtrack a little bit on the recognition aspect of and rebellion. That's partially true. What's incorrect is B.C. Franklin's narrative. B.C. Franklin had only been here a couple of months. He had just arrived in Tulsa. But B.C. Franklin is edified, because had it not been for B.C. Franklin, we wouldn't even be talking about Greenwood today.
That's correct.
Because B.C. Franklin, that's, to me, that's the truest rebellion, because he went and fought them after the massacre. He fought the whole city of Tulsa legally, set up in a tent his whole office in a tent.
Right, that's in the documentary.
He went after the city of Tulsa mm-hmm. to remove those ordinances that tried to basically push us out because they knew we couldn't afford, after the massacre, they knew we couldn't afford to rebuild with fire-resistant materials and build two-story institutional homes because that was the requirement. If you're going to build, you got to build out of fire-resistant materials, and it got to be a two-story structure, and we're not selling you any materials. That was the stipulation. Mm-hmm. They knew we could ethnically cleanse that whole area if we put those stipulations on them because we didn't stole everything they got.
Man.
B.C. Franklin fought them, had the courage to fight them despite the increase in Klan activity, Klan dominance, and went to the Supreme Court and won.
Right on, yeah. B.C.
That
Franklin.
That degree of courage is unparalleled.
Yeah.
Like most folks would have ran. Gurley, that's a different story.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah,
Gurley.
Yeah,
most people don't know Gurley was exiled from Greenwood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is about B.C. Franklin. He, Spears, and Chappelle, they mm-hmm. won that lawsuit.
That's right.
When they sued.
That's right.
Okay. Well, look, I'm gonna get off.
All
and
right.
Open
hey,
it up for
thank you for
and
your
thank
comment.
You again.
Thanks, Kev. Thank you, my brother. All right. 646. Good afternoon.
Hey, Oshie
and Jay. This is Jay from New York, man. Hey, Chief, this is Jay from New York.
Listen, two things.
You're breaking up on me, Jay.
There's two narratives going out. One of the narratives is that the brother who started this whole thing in Tulsa ran off with the white woman and had kids. Is there any truth to that?
Dick Rowland.
Okay, good question. So first of all, where that narrative came from was his adopted mother, Mamie Rowland, right? So I'm going to debunk all of that for everybody who's listening. Mamie Rowland told investigators that that Dick Rowland and Sarah Page went to Kansas City to stay with her family and got married. Let me tell you what's wrong with that. No mother in her right mind would send a posse after her son, who was supposedly responsible for the destruction of Greenwood. Number one, zero sense. She sent them on a goose chase. Number two, Sarah Page testified in Tulsa court that nothing happened between her and Dick Rowland in September of 1921, according to civil records. So in short, the answer is no. It's not possible that it's true. Third, there is a person buried next to Mamie Rowland named Jim Jones. That is Dick Rowland's birth name because Dick Rowland was adopted.
Oh.
I personally believe Dick Rowland was murdered. According to a black newspaper called the Oklahoma Dispatch, black police officer Barney Cleaver stated in that paper when he was interviewed that Dick Rowland was taken to Nebraska with a group of prisoners after the massacre.
Wow.
So there you have it.
And secondly, there was another so-called myth, I don't know how true it is, you would know, that there wasn't as many black businesses as they claimed there was. There wasn't the type of black ownership and community that is being put out there, and that most of the blacks worked for white folks during that period of time. Could you address that?
How many black folks work for white folks today that still own their own business?
Lots.
Eight.
Yeah.
I'm just
right.
You
number
know,
one.
I'm
okay.
Just
I'm just saying. I'm just
you.
That's just commentary. That's just commentary.
Right.
All right. But let me get to the fact of the matter. The fact of the matter is this: we didn't come up with that number of 3 million in property damage. That's their estimate based on race riot insurance claims after the massacre. That does not include the people who did not have insurance. So if you have $3 million in insurance claims in 1921, then whoever is saying that we didn't have that many businesses doesn't understand the economics or mathematics.
Right. Now, the thing is, that money was never collected, if I'm not mistaken, right?
No, they never paid a dime on any insurance claim.
Never paid a dime. Just to go to show the nature of the white man and how he goes about his business at hand. He's always looking for an excuse not to pay out, but he always looking to collect. Now, earlier, Oshie was talking about Mr. Charles Krauthammer. I mean, let me say this, man. You know, unfortunately, we as a people in this whole reparation thing that's been going on for a long period of time just haven't figured out how to really address and deal with this situation, because I in all honesty, kind of understand quite clearly where Charles is coming from. I mean, if I was the white man today, I'm just going to have to be honest with you. I'd give you $25,000 and tell you to go F yourself and don't come back and don't ask for nothing else. And unfortunately, most of the Negroes would be happy to gladly accept it and go on about their business, because the narrative, in all truthfulness, hasn't been presented properly or on the level to where, as like you said, you say $3 million back in the 1920s. $3 million in the 1920s today, 100 years later, I would say would be worth $200 million or maybe more.
$600 million is the current estimate.
Okay, so that right there just tells you something. The point of the matter is, you know, I saw what happened last week with that whole Tulsa thing. I'm glad that the people didn't fall for what them Jews were putting together that was using the legends and the rest of them to promote that nonsense. So I'm happy that that was canceled. But my question to you is this, brother. You had your Negro apologist gatekeepers there, the Tiffany Crosses, the Roland Martin, and the rest of them. Could you honestly tell me, were you part of that and what was achieved? In all honesty, because to me it seemed like nothing was achieved but to make black folks feel good and, to be honest with you, give white folks a symbolic pass. Let's keep it real.
I don't think that the people that he works with took that. I believe there was definitely some individuals and maybe some groups in Tulsa were happy to see them come, happy to see Tulsa Rising, the museum, come up, happy to see the work that is being done with the mass graves and so forth. But the overall project, the overall completion, which is restitution, reparations, compensation and so forth for the descendants as well. I mean, for the descendants as well as the survivors. I don't know. I don't think so. What do you think, Chief? Chief, are you there?
Don't tell me we lost the chief.
Oh, man. Yeah, the technology happens. Yeah.
Why does it always happen when the most important questions are asked?
Yeah.
I mean, this is just absolutely horrible. Because he would know the answers. Because to me, to have Roland Martin, Tiffany Cross, and the rest of those Negroes there don't mean nothing to me, man.
I'm sorry, I got disconnected.
Hold on, we're disconnected. He's back now. Go ahead. Did you hear the question, Chief?
Thank goodness.
I heard him talking about Tiffany Cross, and I lost after that.
Right. He was basically saying to have Tiffany, go ahead. Go ahead, Jay.
To have the Tiffany Crosses and the Roland Martins and all them there, I mean, what was achieved?
What was what?
What was
achieved?
Oh, what was achieved?
What was gained other than to make black folks feel good and white folks feel as though they're getting a slight pass?
Well, I think that, you know, you heard from some of the callers today, the fact that this is 2021 and you have millions of people who still don't know is a big deal, right? And the more we can get this out, because now we have to leverage black media so that we can get this narrative out, we can get the story out, you know, because Oklahoma is, you know, this is the center place. People don't come to Oklahoma, right? And so we have to leverage that as much as we possibly can.
Exactly.
Right? They have a job to do. They do their job. They media. That's what they do. Right? On the other level, those of us who discover this narrative, who discover this story, the question becomes, what are we going to do? What do we do with the information that we now have? How are we going to collectively ensure that there is some repair, that there is some restorative justice? What are we going to do to make that happen? Like, we don't have another place where there's this much evidence, where a whole study has been done to talk about, to deal with who's culpable, like we do right here in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. Right. So we utilize those institutions and we leverage that. Right. If we expecting people who have a job to do that, you know, and that's what their job is. If we going to hold them accountable, we'd have a whole lot of people we got to hold accountable. But the reality is those of us who know.
So how do we leverage it? How do we use it to our benefit to make these
Well, the first thing we got to do is we have to stop letting people define what justice looks like for us.
Right.
Right. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that. Every person who has asked me, even when I went to Congress to testify, who has asked me, what does reparations look like to you? My response is, if you take everything, you give back everything. If you take money, if you take institutions, if you take legacy, if you take generational wealth, if you take land, you have to restore all of it. That's why they don't have no problem saying, oh, yeah, we'll throw some cash. Well, they do have a problem with that when it's collective.
Right.
When it's individual, oh, they'll throw some money at you. They'll give Breonna Taylor's family millions of dollars or these individuals. But when it's a collective issue, they know it ain't just about money. They're used to throwing money at their problems. They've always thrown money at every problem that they have. That's why you have settlements and all these different things. But the truth of the matter is,
that's what you're supposed to do.
Well, it may be.
That's how you get rid of the problem and the nature of the white man.
Well, you got the problem. The problem with us.
Hold on, Jay.
But the problem with us is the problem with us is bigger than money.
Right.
It's always been bigger than money, and they know it is. That's the thing.
Right.
Right?
But
that's
why
they can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's it. Right there. We don't.
We don't realize that the bigger picture is, like you say, the payback. The bigger picture is not so much having people identify the issue. It's to identify the issue and to be repaired for the damage. That's where black people get caught up in. They, feel that it's all right to identify what happened to us, but don't feel as though we need to be compensated and we should have forgiveness for the filthy, stinking devil and what they've done. So that's where you get the Jesse Lee Petersons and the rest of these Negroes from, who absolutely become, I feel in a sense, the gatekeepers. I'll leave you with this. There's a big thing going on right now with critical race theory.
Yes, and we just passed a bill in Oklahoma.
And the basic thing about it is, and I saw it last night, man, on on television with Mark Lamont Hill. When he asked one of these young, dumb conservatives, if you can see the clip, you should really see it. And this is where we get caught out here. Lamont asked him one simple question. Name me something that has been applicable in society with critical race theory, or name me someone that you've read in regards to critical race theory, and he couldn't answer it. It's just like everybody in your legislation in Tulsa that's talking about critical race theory, if you ask them to tell you what it is and define it, I bet you $1 million the bastards couldn't do it. Not near one of them, because they don't know what it is. Because in all truthfulness, it's never been taught in anything other than on the master's level and the PhD level.
Hey, Jay,
it ain't been taught in daily application.
You're right. Hey, Jay.
Jay,
I got to get ready to go, man. But listen, I appreciate the call.
But could you ask him to address that, please, before you go? Oh, because that's important.
Sure. And in fact, I'm going to comment right quick, and I'm going to have him have the last word, have him as the guest and have the last word. The issue of Tulsa, Black Wall Street, and the massacres that have happened, not just in Tulsa, Rosewood, Elaine, Arkansas, all the so many of them, that's critical race theory. What it is that telling the truth, exposing the lies, dealing with history factually, regardless of how you feel about it. They didn't want to talk about critical race theory. They didn't want to talk about what happened in 1619. No, they have this thing called the 1776 curriculum of the great founding fathers. They don't want to talk about captivity and enslavement. They don't want to talk about the removal of human beings from their land and killing them and so forth. No, they don't want to talk about that. They don't want to talk about the truth. Because just like the character in A Few Good Men of Jack Nicholson, Corporal General Jessup, you can't handle the truth. And that's what it is. So go ahead, brother Chief Gumawala. You can wrap up.
Yes, sir. I'll be real brief, too. We're going to have to develop some think tanks, right? Some serious think tanks. And we're going to have to stop being crisis-oriented. Right? Because everything we're talking about right now, we got a precursor of what was to come when the FBI report came out a few years ago about them doing investigations on racial, they started this program for Black identity extremists.
Right, Black identity extremists.
Right?
Yep.
We didn't pay attention. People didn't pay attention to that. Right? I was telling people then, y'all, they setting us up. They're getting us ready for a real serious plan to marginalize our identity. What's the best way to do that? Race theory legislation.
Right?
That's how you deal with it from an educational standpoint. That's the programming part of it, right? And you enhance the idea of supremacy and superiority by the continued effort to erase people from history, right? We just got to get out of this crisis-oriented mindset where we become so reactionary to the situations that are happening today that we don't have a countermeasure. Like, I hear the problem. I hear the issue. What's the countermeasure? We haven't even thought about the checkmate, right? That's it. That's a checkmate moment. Like, what do you do at that point? What's the plan beyond that besides – because I didn't got to that age. You get to that age where you like, okay, let me master my blood pressure as well, right? I can't engage in fights just to be fighting. We have to engage in fights with the idea to win.
That's right.
Like, I don't want to hear it. I've been in a fight for 30 years, but what's the win look like? We got to win.
That's right. What progress has been made?
We got to have measures. Yes. We got to produce these think tanks. Like your program becomes a think tank, and you push for, you bring people on who are going to push ideas of solution. Mm-hmm. Like solution, you can be a revolutionary, but a revolutionary should be a solutionary.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And those, we got to be able to push those efforts. Yeah. So that's why, look at us today. We in Tulsa, Oklahoma, we have a lawsuit, and we simply said, since we didn't beat them in the Supreme Court through reparations, because we can't try the same case twice. It's already gone to the Supreme Court, was denied on the statute of limitations. So my cousin, the attorney, Demario Solomon, said, let's push an ordinance lawsuit, a nuisance lawsuit. The state of Oklahoma sued the pharmaceutical industry for $52 million dollars and won $527 million.
That's right, for the opioids.
Right, because mm-hmm. they look at the opioid crisis and the long-term effects that haven't even happened yet. They're looking at the long-term effects of this kind of nuisance and how it will affect all of the communities that have been impacted through opioid problems. When we put that side by side, the events of 1921, urban renewal in 1967, or urban removal in 1967, because like I said, the Congress, we don't have a past problem. We have concurrent problems because we haven't caught a break since we've been in this country.
That's right.
So you can't say that was in the past when every event has been concurrent to a past event.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we look at that and we said, okay, everything matches. The resistance shows up in the form of denying us access to Open Records Act, mm-hmm. right, which is illegal, basically. Like, you can't even do that. All that told us is that we haven't even scratched the surface to the level of damage and wickedness in a court. That's based right. on this 1921 massacre.
Man.
We ain't even scratched the surface.
That's right. Well, listen, my brother, you know, I will be continuing to communicate with you. I'll hopefully have
Absolutely.
You back on this program, you know, when particularly come back on when there's some new developments or information that you want to share. You're always welcome,
yes, sir.
Chief. And I appreciate you very much, my brother. Thank you so much.
Yes. Oh, I will say that we found 27 bodies in the mass grave location in one location as of yesterday.
Man.
Yeah. So keep us in your prayers, you know, as we
always, brother.
Continue to discover these remains.
Exactly. Brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they sure in hell don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, you have a great weekend. Be safe out there. Shem Hotep means go in peace. Esante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fahodie. Bibi Fahodie means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, Bibi Fahodie, we will be victorious. You have a great and safe and wonderful weekend, brothers. Peace.